From Johannesburg to Jerusalem, the world is always changing, growing and innovating. Join Benji Shulman for the next hour as he brings you the trendsetters, the thought leaders and those creating news before it happens. Only on the New Blue Review, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. Every Monday at 9 a.m. right here on 101.9 Chai FM.
You're listening to 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. Welcome to the program on this Monday morning. Hope that you are doing extremely well out there, even if it is a little bit cloudy and a little bit cool. We still seem to be in the grip of winter, although I must say, I have started to see the occasional spring blossoms starting to pop out where you see them from time to time. So maybe we're starting to see a process of that changing. So who knows? We will find out soon. But in the meantime, it's hot in the studio today because we have all of the best news and views and issues for you in between current affairs and culture that we have on the show, as we do every single week for you. So what is coming up in the show for today? Well, we're going to be talking about heritage and culture in Johannesburg and where you can find some of it. We're going to be looking into who are the Druze. Lots of information about Druze coming up, given that Assyria has been in the news. So we're going to find out who are the Druze and what do they do and why are they suddenly in the news. And we're going to be looking at the Israeli creator. He's using AI to make impactful history more accessible. We're going to be talking about a Muslim visit to Israel from Europe, a very interesting group there. And we're going to be talking around ties of Iran to South Africa and what does that mean for the rest of us here in the country. So that is all coming up on the show today. And we'd love you to be part of the conversation. We love it when our listeners are able to give their viewpoints about what it is that we are talking about. So if you do want to be part of the conversation, 061-895-1019, that is the line to make use of. We would love to have you on. It would be great to chat with you and get your opinions. So let's start off and talk about history and heritage in the city of Johannesburg and how you can be a part of it, because it's extremely, extremely interesting. So the reason that I wanted to chat about this was, you might not be aware of this fact, but the city of Johannesburg is really one of the few cities in the world that has a Jewish population, significant Jewish population, at the founding of the city, right? Most cities in the world don't have that. Jews either moved to cities after they were established by other places or because of exile were already there. And so most cities in the world don't have a Jewish connection right at the beginning, even if they have very old Jewish populations, specifically in Europe. But even, I mean, if you read the history of Jerusalem, you know, it was an existing city before King David decided to make it its capital. So there is this thing. And really, Johannesburg, maybe some cities in the United States, depending on how you look at it, you could make this claim. But really, Johannesburg has this thing where Jews were really at the forefront and the beginnings of the city in a very, very big way. You know, if you go back and look at the history of Johannesburg, for example, you might be interested to be aware that on Yom Kippur, the stock exchange in Johannesburg actually used to close down because so many Jews were involved in the finance of the city through the landlords and the people who came here for the mining and all of that. So it's a very interesting thing. But from the perspective of when you start to dig into the history of the city, you actually start to find that you're also digging through the Jewish history of the city in quite often in different ways. And so it was true for a visit that I made yesterday to something called the Tolstoy Farm, which is in Lanasia, on the far end of Lanasia. And the Tolstoy Farm is an interesting farm because it's a place that was bought for Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi was, as you are aware, one of the leaders in the push to make India independent from Britain, but he spent a lot of his life in South Africa, and particularly in Johannesburg, where he developed the so-called Satyagraha, the soul force, non-violent resistance, different names. But basically, his political program to force different authorities not through the use of violence in order to really drive his program of rights for Indians, first in South Africa and then in the wider empire in Britain. And he started off here because the Transvaal, as it was then, was restricting Indian rights in different ways, and they had to have passes and all sorts of things. And so Gandhi actually created a range of pass-related defiance campaigns where they burned passes, went to jail, and never acted violently. The idea was really to actually try and to try and force the authorities to jail so many people that the system would be overwhelmed. And he did a great deal of this through here in Johannesburg. He started off as a lawyer, and he came to South Africa dealing with inter-Indian legal affairs, and then slowly but surely went from legal remedies to more what they call direct action, protest marches and sit-ins and fasts and all these type of issues. And in the process, he started to develop networks and engagements and lots of different elements, excuse me, and started to also develop a network of allies that he could count on. And one of these allies was a guy called Herman Kallenbach, who was a Lithuanian Jew of kind of German heritage and culture, and who came to South Africa and was a very successful architect. He built a number of buildings in South Africa, particularly in Johannesburg. Many of them religious buildings. There's a church in Hillbrow that he built for the Greek Orthodox community. A Temple Israel as well, I believe. A number of other things. But if you've ever been in Lynxfield, you would have definitely been part of the roads that he built and a number of other parts of the city of the infrastructure that were actually created in because of his work. And he kind of opened up the northeastern side of Johannesburg, and so for example, things like Sylvia's Pass was also something that he worked on, and so he had all of these things. But he met with Gandhi, and he was sort of a figure that was connected to him, and developed a friendship, and the two of them became very, very close with one another as friends, and started doing this work of that Gandhi was involved in, and trying to figure out some of the philosophical and political and different issues that were connected to what Gandhi was doing. And Kallenbach was not the only Jew that was around him. The Polaks, Polak family, acted as a big supporter of his. His secretary, Sonia Sleshin, she was a big part of his life. I believe that she might have been the first woman to actually get a legal degree in South Africa, and she helped Gandhi. So there was a lot of these Jews that were around that were assisting Gandhi in the work that he was doing, but Kallenbach in particular was a big friend of his, and this was an important part of his life and what he did. And what we're going to be chatting about after we come back from the break is that we're going to be talking about what this then inspired in Kallenbach to do, and how it really affected the relationship between the two and what Gandhi would go on to do in general. My name is Benji Shulman, and this is 101.9 Chai FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. I am Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review, your current affairs and culture show here on 101.9 Chai FM. And we're talking this morning about the history and culture of Johannesburg and the role that the Jewish community played in it. And we're talking in particular about Gandhi and his relationship with the Jewish community. And I've been talking about the various Jews that he was connected to, and also what impact that they had. And in particular, we're talking about this architect Hermann Kallenbach, and what he did with his life and Gandhi's life. And so basically, as they became friendly, they started working out together. Kallenbach was a big one for vegetarian eating, like Gandhi. He used to wake up every morning and do a lot of exercise, drink water. And they actually moved into a place together called Satyayoga House. Well, it's now called Satyayoga House. They called it the Krolls back in the day. But basically, it was a house which is in Orchards Road, and in Orchards, just near the Orange Grove Shul. And it's literally next door. And this is where they lived and worked together for some time. And it became a significant site in the city for interest in what Gandhi did. And they've turned it now into a museum stroke guest house, and you can actually stay there, and they do make vegetarian meals and do yoga, and you can live there, but there's also a museum where you can actually see where Gandhi slept, and all of this. And as this friendship developed, Kallenbach, who was kind of a very like materialist person, he had cars which were unusual at the time and expensive things, and he started sort of taking on more of the ascetic view of the world that Gandhi had. You know, Gandhi, everything was about him was simple, and he didn't want to do. He sort of just wanted to create his own things from hand and from scratch. And at one point, he actually shouted at Kallenbach because he owned all these luxurious items. And there's a scene where Kallenbach throws overboard an expensive pair of binoculars that he had been keeping because of Gandhi shouting at him. But what's interesting about Tolstoy Farm is that Gandhi decided that he wanted a sort of a retreat where he could bring families that were during the Defiance campaign struggling with their families. People were in jail for defying the pass laws, and they were being arrested for burning the parcels, and so they were struggling. And so what Gandhi did was he created this farm where people could go. They would farm their own food. They would make sandals every day. There would be a school. Everyone would have to wake up early, and families could actually live there. About 80 people would go to this farm, and they named it after Leo Tolstoy, the famous Russian literary author who had a very big interest in peasants and Russian Revolution and all these sorts of things. And Gandhi was a big fan, and he had been corresponding with Tolstoy. And so they named the farm after him, and people went there and lived. For about 3 years, this farm was operating. It's 35 kilometers from the center of Joburg, which is very interesting because Gandhi, again, he was very simple about his lifestyle. And so he actually insisted that people, if they wanted to go to Joburg, they would have to walk. I mean, there's a train station right there, but he insisted everyone would walk to Joburg, and they would all do it together in a group. So if there was a need to go to Johannesburg, everyone would wake up early, and they would walk the 35 Ks, do what they needed to do, buy whatever they needed to buy, and then all walk back the same day. So it was a big part of what he did. And this place, sort of after Gandhi left South Africa and he went to India during the First World War, sort of fell into disrepute or disuse, rather. And it's in a sort of poor, remote area of Joburg anyway. And at various times, there were attempts to restore it. And now, eventually, was taken over by a brick factory. And there's a committee that also works now to preserve the heritage of the place. Not much of the original housing or anything is left, but they do still have some of the areas where people would have lived and engaged with one another, and you can actually visit it as part of the heritage of the city, and see this kind of social experiment, kind of like a kibbutz maybe or an ashram. When Gandhi would go back overseas to India, he would establish a similar sort of thing in India, and so there's connections between the two, and so there is a this heritage that exists in South Africa between these Jews and many other members of other faiths who were working together to try and improve things in the world. And what's interesting actually about it is that Kallenbach was a big supporter of Gandhi, believed very much in nonviolence. But as the 20th century wore on, and you had the First World War, and then of course the Second World War, and the destruction of international Jewry, basically Kallenbach, he came to believe that a principled view of nonviolence under all circumstances wasn't something that could be sustained. And it wasn't that him and Gandhi had a falling out. They were still good friends, and they saw one another and whatever. But eventually, he stopped believing in nonviolence at all costs and became a Zionist, and was part of the Zionist Federation here in South Africa. And he tried as much as he could to actually influence Gandhi to support the State of Israel when India was created at a similar time. And Gandhi was very opposed. He didn't feel that Jews and Arabs should be fighting with one another in that part of the world, and so therefore he didn't agree with Zionism, and also because he saw it as being something British, etc. So there was this kind of gap between the two of them, but nonetheless they still remained friends and engaged with one another. And there's letters from Kallenbach and others to, I think, Buber, Martin Buber, actually talking to him and trying to convince him and lobby him on this question because of the links that he had with the Jewish world. And the reason why all of this is very interesting is that there is an attempt now to create a directory of heritage in the city. There's all these sites and these places inside the city that tell us about the history of the city. And they've actually gone, the city of Joburg has gone and created something which is very nice. And it's got, I don't know, 80 sites or 90 sites of different historical importance, including those like you'll sometimes see when you're driving around. They have these blue plaques that will sort of tell you that this is an important place. And you can see them all over the place. I mean, I was walking on Shabbat in Waverley, and there was a house there, and you find them at the like old bars and places that have heritage tree values and all sorts of things. So they've actually put this together now, and you can actually see the different historical sites that have importance all around you in the city. And I think that's a very very interesting project, and one which now I have a friend who actually has made it a something that he wants to visit every single one of these sites in the city by a certain date. I don't think we all have to do that because some of them are kind of far away. But even if you go to there's something called the heritageportal.co.za, it'll actually show you all the different parts of the city which is being conserved for future generations, so that we don't forget the history that we have in the city and look after it, because it's an amazing part of the history of humanity and by extension the Jewish history of the city and of the world. So it's absolutely a fascinating discussion. We have a message here. I got the name of the shul wrong. Thank you, Rabbi. Rabbi Goldman messaging in here to say that it's Pine Street Shul. I called it Orange Grove Shul. That's correct. It's in fact Pine Street Shul. And it is next door, this place. Pine Street Shul is next door this the Satyayoga house, which you can visit, and I would encourage you to do that. You can go to shul and then go afterwards and visit the house, and it's a really interesting and quite a cool place to go visit. By the way, if you also want to correct me if I'm getting any facts wrong, 0618951019, that is the WhatsApp line, and we are happy to take any of your calls and messages really and voice notes. Let's stay with the historical theme for a minute. I think we can get all the history out the way instead of bouncing up and down, and then we'll get to the geopolitics. But how do you make history interesting for young people? You know, it's all very well going to visit the sites, which is very important, but not everyone has time, and you have to get people interested first. And also, you know, even the best historical sites, it's often best to go with a proper storyteller, because otherwise it's just a field or just a statue or whatever. You need to get to the stories behind what's going on. And I think that one of the interesting things is coming out of Israel at the moment. So there's a guy called Naz Daily, who you may have followed before. He's a very considerable creator in the space in the world, in Israel. He was famous. He's a Arab Israeli guy from Nazareth, and he started a program called This Is 1 Minute. These 1 minute, basically, he would create 1 minute videos where he would travel to different countries around the world and tell a story about that country, and it would all be 1 minute. It would all be filmed in a very kind of special way and smart way, and then and it would tell the story of a different country that he had gone to. Incidentally, he's not a big fan of South Africa, not for any political reason or anything, but just because the first two times that he ever came here, they kept stealing his camera. So I don't think he was so keen on that. But nonetheless, he never says anything horrible about us. He just had a bit of a rough time when he was here last. Nonetheless, Naz Daily, he would do these stories, and at the end of it, he would be like, this is 1 minute, see you tomorrow. And then I think it was like for, I don't know how many, did it for like a year or 2 years, something like that. It was insane. Every day he would do these stories and fly all around and do all this stuff. So he was doing all of this stuff. And then as a result of this, he went to America and he founded a production company in California where he lives now, and in New York, and is doing all of these things. And after October 7th, he came under a lot of pressure because he was an Arab Israeli. He was out there in public, and you know, he's not right wing or anything like that, but he is still an Israeli, and he had actually been a big supporter, for example, of the Abraham Accords, and he went out to I think the UAE when they were first being formed, and he was doing videos about that. And as a result, he was actually attacked by Al Jazeera. They created a hit piece on him, and then sort of pushed up a lot of advertising spend to try and push back on the work that he was doing. And after October 7th, he actually sort of really just said, look guys, this is not acceptable anymore. And he really came out to say, we need to stop Hamas and find a way forward. And it was a very powerful voice, and one which, you know, is very brave of him to do it. But now he's embarked on a new project, which I think is almost as interesting, if not more, than his first project. And he is still doing this 1 minute see you tomorrow type idea, except now he is doing it about history, and he's also doing it not physically, but doing it AI. So what he's done is he's taken historical events, different historical events from all around the world. He's done one, for example, on the history of Mansa Musa, who was a Mali king who owned like half the world's gold at the time and was an extremely rich individual. And he's done another one on the history of Anwar Sadat, who made peace with Israel and Egypt. And he's done all sorts of other interesting historical figures and parts of history that maybe don't get normal mainstream attention. And what he's done is he makes like a video of what happened, but because it's AI, he almost inserts himself as a person into the actual video. So he kind of travels around with the video and tells a story and tells quite complicated historical things in 1 minute in AI, and then puts it out to his Twitter and his Facebook for everyone to see and engage with. And I have to say, I think it's quite an innovative approach, because a lot of people look at this and they see it and they find it interesting and they don't know the history. And it's not history as maybe you and I learned at school, lots of dates and it's boring. It looks very live and visual, and he does it extremely well. And he's a good storyteller. So he brings all of this history to life. I think he's only been doing it now for a couple of weeks, but he's doing one every single day. So if you're interested in seeing how history is being told and done in the new age, you can go have a look at this and see it, and it's really quite fascinating. So that's Naz Daily, and he's doing these 1 minute things, and he's doing it, he says, in the aid of peace, which I think is very interesting. He's saying people misuse history, are ignorant of history, and so as a result they can be pushed towards violence because they don't have a proper knowledge of what is actually going on. And so he's using his platform really to spread good messages around the world, using historical narrative and these new tools of AI in a positive way that can help us to bridge divides and help one another. And I think that is a really commendable and a fantastic way to make use of this new technology, which he really is able to do at a different way because of his abilities. So I think that is an absolutely fantastic thing, and one which I think you should go have an opportunity to go have a look at if you would like to do so. I am Benji Shulman, and this is 101.9 High FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
I am Benji Shulman, and this is 101.9 High FM. You're listening to the New Blue Review, your current affairs and culture show. And we're talking about various issues that are going on at the moment in the world. We've been talking a lot about history and culture today, and now we are going to move on to some geopolitics to see what is going on in the world. So one of them is a project that I've been somewhat involved with, looking at the ties between Iran and South Africa, which is becoming more and more of a serious question that is going on, and something which people are paying attention to. So, for example, we saw last week caused a bit of a kerfuffle with the president, because the DA came out and said that Nkabisi Jonas, the special envoy from South Africa to America, had been denied a diplomatic visa and that he hadn't really been in America and hadn't been doing any sort of work, even though he was appointed several months ago. You'll notice he wasn't in the meeting of the White House between Ramaphosa and Trump. And where has he been? And the reason why the Americans seem to be opposed to him, partly he made some nasty comments about Trump, but then who hasn't? This was years ago. But it's more to do with the fact that he is the chairman of MTN. And there is a court case that is currently proceeding, two in fact, one in the U.S. where a group of people in the U.S. are actually suing MTN for the work that they for you'll hear now about what they're doing. And then there's another court case which we are going to find out from in the Constitutional Court about what is happening there. And the reason why it's gone to the Concord is that in about 2012, MTN was bidding for a license to run the cellular communications in Iran, so-called MTN Iransel. And they won the license to operate in the country, but they pushed out in the process another competitor, Turkcell, was a Turkish company that was doing the same thing. And as a result of this, Turkcell was very aggrieved. And what they've alleged and what they've said about MTN, which I should be clear, MTN has denied, is that they said that they've alleged that MTN has bribed their way into taking in taking away that contract from Turkcell. And they said that the bribe consisted of a range of different things, obviously money because it was a bribe, but also that it would entail MTN leaning on the South African government to assist Iran in international fora. In particular, there was a lot of votes coming out of the IAEA, the Iran nuclear program, where South Africa was defending Iran's right to engage in nuclear development. So it was a big deal. And the other lawsuit that I was talking about, they alleged that somehow through this process, Iran got access to technology that was on the sanctions list and that that would have been used against American soldiers. And so the Americans are very annoyed about this. Now, what's interesting about this is, first of all, the chairman of MTN at the time was someone you may have heard of, who's now the president of the country. His name is Cyril Ramaphosa. So he would have been at the center of this thing at the time, and now it's sort of become part of the public record. And he, of course, is the president. But also, we have a situation where Turkcell then went all around the world and said, well, we want to try this case. And they went to America and they said, look, this is not an American issue. The court doesn't have jurisdiction there. Then they were going to go to Iranian courts, and the decision there was that you can't, the Iranian courts are not independent and they're not going to give us a fair hearing. And so eventually, because MTN is a South African company, they approached South African courts. The High Court said that they don't want them to have them here. Then they appealed that to the Supreme Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court of Appeals actually said, no, they can do it here, but they need to do it under South African law. And now it's gone to the Constitutional Court to look into this question. And it's going to be a few months now while we wait for the Concord to make a decision, I believe. But if the Concord decides that this is a matter that can be heard in a South African court, because it involves a South African company involved in bribery and corruption charges from around the world, then all of this stuff is going to spill out into the public sphere. And there's going to be a lot of discussion around this in terms of what's happening and why and who was involved. And we know, assuming that these are legitimate emails, a lot of stuff came out of the company and you can kind of see them having to make these decisions around some of this stuff. And in fact, outside of this case, someone has already been charged and convicted. And so a report has been issued now looking at some of the stuff, looking at the broader Iran issues. Why is it that Iran and the ANC are so connected with one another? It's a report which shows that actually the relationship between the ANC and Iran goes back many years. The Iranian Ayatollahs used to support the ANC for many years, even though they were also at the same time buying arms from the apartheid government, and that was, they built on that as well as the Iranians' anti-Western ideology to keep driving things together. And as a result of that, we've also seen a change in the ANC's policy, even on the question of the Palestinians, because typically they would have engaged with the PLO, which was Fatah and this kind of secular Palestinian groups. But over time, we've started to see that the ANC government was engaging with Hamas. In 2015, we saw Hamas sign an MOU with the ANC. And then, of course, after October 7th, the ANC always maintained that it was just a party political affiliation. But then Naledi Pandor actually phoned Hamas directly and asked them about what was going on. Hamas claimed it was to congratulate them. Pandor said it was for humanitarian aid. Then Pandor actually traveled to the United States, to Iran, on an unscheduled flight. And of course, after this, we had the ICJ ruling coming out extremely quickly. So this has been a big deal. It's going to be a big deal. And if you want to try get to grips with it, you can have a look at it in this report. It's on the website for the Middle East Africa Research Institute, meari.org. and it will give you a lowdown into what is going on, because the Americans are getting increasingly frustrated. And if you look at these executive orders and this congressional stuff that's coming out, it keeps referencing Iran. And unless we start to fix this relationship, and if it starts to come out in this next court case that there was serious corruption, I think that this could become the center of a major problem and focus for the South African body politic for the next while. So that is a very interesting development. We'll have to see when it can be done. So keep following, I'm sure the station will be following it very closely. I'm Menji Shulman, and this is 101.9 Chai FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. And I want to just finish off the show by talking about the Druze. So you would have seen perhaps in the media in the last while this question of Syria and fights breaking out between the Druze and Bedouin tribes, and then the Syrian government getting involved and massacring people. Notably, not a lot of outcry from the international community on this. The Israelis getting involved by bombing Syrian targets to try and kind of force a bit of a ceasefire, which seems to be happening at the moment. And this has been something that's been going on regularly. But who are the Druze? What are their role here? So it's a very interesting grouping, the Druze. Druze are a ethnic religious group in a similar way to the way Jews are. And there's a few million of them in the world. I think only 1.5 or 2 million of them. And they mostly are in Lebanon, Syria, Israel, and now also in a little bit in America and around the world. And they have a very interesting religion in that there's a definite cut between who are the religious people, so to speak, and you have like ordinary people. So it's kind of a priestly class who go off and learn the secrets of the religion. And then you have the rest of Druze society who still follow the customs but are not as engaged in the learning of the religion like the rest of the Druze are. And they live in all over the place, and they have terrific food. If you ever have the opportunity to eat Druze food, you really should have the opportunity to do so. But traditionally, what's interesting about the Druze is that they are a people who will support whoever is in power in their particular area. So if you're a Druze and you're in Syria, you would support the Syrian government. If you're a Druze and you're in Israel, you support the Israeli government. And really, this has always been the approach. And so Druze are people who serve in the army. They are parts of units. They're very, very high up in different parts of the Israeli military as various kind of office corps and whatever. You find lots of Druze who are part of this. And in general, in Israeli society, you'll find Druze who are part of that. And also integrating quite effectively into different elements. I've been to Druze projects where they're helping to work with Druze women to improve their lifestyle and to healthcare and economics, which is an absolutely fascinating element of Israeli society. And their villages are in these places like Carmel and all of this stuff, and it's a really interesting part of what they do. So the big issue has been now suddenly that the Syrian Druze are, because they're not Muslims, under attack by these Islamist groups that have now taken over Syria. And so Israel has put a kind of buffer zone around them because they have the Israeli Druze population is also related to the Syrian ones and are concerned about what might happen to them if this new Syrian government starts to take revenge, because their own people will then start doing things. And this is what we actually saw, is that Druze were storming the border from the Israeli side to get to the Syrian side to defend their clans from the people that were attacking them. And so Israel's taken quite a hard line. It also creates a kind of buffer zone between them and Syria, which they appreciate because they don't want the Syrians on their border. And so as a result, Israel is taking and trying to stop the Syrian government from getting involved with Druze affairs, and including blowing up some HQs and some some TV stations or whatever to make it clear that this is not something that they will accept. Don't mess with the Druze, who are themselves quite good fighters. And it shows a shift in the politics of the Middle East in the way that it is operating. So definitely a story that we're going to have to keep an eye on. Brings us to the end of the show. Thanks you to everyone who helps make it possible. Craig, who pushes all the big red buttons, to Vusi, who's on the sound, and to you, dear listener, who joins us every single week. Join us next week. We're going to be talking to Tony Leon about his new book here on the New Blue Review.